Good Saturday morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode we have here at Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. Today we are joined by three fantastic authors. Starting off, we're going to have Stephen James, then we're going to have Andrea Creamer, and then we're going to dial it on up here with Rick Lofina. So it's a good time to sit back and relax. I know college football has started today, but that's okay because we have plenty of time to dive into all of that too. So we will talk to you and we will see you here. So 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. On this Saturday morning here on Suspense Radio, and I said 60 minutes, and I was a little bit wrong. I meant this is going to be a 90-minute show with our three authors. And we're going to bring our first one up here right now, who is probably talking to us from the southeast part of the country, hot, humid weather. Stephen James, the author of The Queen, the Patrick Bauer series, book 5, is out. So, Stephen, how you doing? Nice to talk to you again. Been thrilled with us.
Yeah, it's been a few weeks, but it's great to be back. It's good to talk to you, John.
Yeah. And so The Queen is finally out. I mean, we've waited and waited, and now it finally is out here. Fifth book in the Patrick Bauer series, and it's a little bit different than the first one because you're bringing in a little bit more foreign influence into this book. What was the behind-the-scenes kind of with that part of, you know, moving Patrick into this direction?
Well, if you've read in any of the previous books, you know that he's an FBI agent who uses cutting-edge technology to track mainly serial killers, arsonists, and so on. So a lot of the earlier ones have a real dark kind of suspense, psychological suspense feel, but I didn't want every book in the series to be a cookie cutter. Too many mm-hmm. series that I've read, every book ends up being basically the same story, just retold with different names and a different killer and so on. So I wanted a different feel, so this time I went more toward kind of 24, Tom Clancy sort of espionage, and
right.
And I wanted the same feel with Patrick solving the crimes, but I wanted a completely different plot, so it has more to do with eco-terrorism, and it's been exciting because readers have been really happy to see that it's not the same, it's not just a repeated story told over again.
Yeah, and so now, did you have this in mind because, you know, coming forward, this is book 5, you know, this could be the time because you have three more books left in the series, but one of them, you know, we talked about is when you're going to go back and it's going to be called Opening Move, and you're going to talk about the dynamic of how Patrick kind of became the way that he is and things like that, which is a very smart thing. But then we have the Queen or the King and Checkmate, which are going to finish these two out. So with book 5 kind of where you kind of did like the turning point where everything starts to maneuver into a different way for the last two, was that your idea going into it?
You know, a little bit. There's been a growing narrative in the series about a bad guy named Richard Bass. And I made some big promises in the earlier books, basically about a face-off that's going to happen between Patrick and this killer named Richard Bass. And so In The Queen, it ends up that you find out who Basque's partner is, and then you also sort of find out what happens with Patrick's love interest. And so with this book, I really wanted to fulfill some of those promises but also propel the series forward. So it takes a step away a little bit and regroups and gets ready for the next few books, just like you mentioned, yeah.
Because, you know, like you said, you know, you find a lot of things out, but you've left a lot of things, I think, still into the secret. And when we're coming down to the end of Checkmate, because what I love about, you know, series is when I know there's an end. So, like I said, like the Star Wars series, you know, Revenge of the Sith is when he's turning into Darth Vader. And I think the buildup of that was so great. And the thing about Checkmate what you're going to have and what you've been able to build up here in these first five books is there going to be a defining ending, or are you just going to, are you going to leave it open? Because you have so many layers going on right now in these books that you got a lot of work to do in the last two to pull these off.
Well, the truth is, I love this character, Patrick Bowers, and, you know, writing about him in The Pawn, the Rook, the Knight, Bishop, and the Queen now,
yeah.
I've really gotten to just enjoy the character, but I appreciate what you said, and that's something I like, too, is saying, okay, do we want to keep this going on forever, or do we want to bring it to some sort of close, and then who knows in the future if you do something again, I'd rather just sort of build up to climax and then kind of see what happens with the new series. And so it's been exciting to watch the progression of this character, and I do have a lot of story threads. I'm actually excited about building them in and working them into some conclusive narratives and plot lines.
Well, you have propelled yourself now into stratosphere, the way that you're writing and your thriller writing is going ever since The Pawn and now up into The Queen, where, you know, we labeled The Bishop, which was book four, as the 2010 book of the year by Suspense Magazine. So now, and The Queen, you know, we've kind of mentioned that The Queen is now one of the best in the series. Now, do you feel extra added pressure knowing that your success coming from The Pawn now to The Queen, where you're now, you know, pushing yourself up into that top tier of thriller suspense writers now in just five books?
Yeah, honestly, I put a lot of pressure on myself with each book. I want it to be better than the one before. And it seems like a lot of authors have one or two stories in them, and then stories kind of peter out. But it's been really a little humbling to see that in the reviews, each book seems to get better reviews. People say this is the best one, or this is almost the best one, or, you know, this is my favorite. So as I've started working on opening moves. I'm working on it right now. I wrote a little this morning, and I feel this incredible pressure. Like, all right, this has to be better. The twist has to be, more clever than anything you've ever done before. And you just sit here and say, man, how am I going to do that?
And speaking of opening moves, because, you know, we've talked about this before, too, that this is, you know, it's coming out. Is it going to come out before The King?
Yeah, actually, I thought I would bring it out before The King and kind of reboot the series. That way, readers can catch up, come up with The King, and then Checkmate. I think a lot of series, you read the whole series, it comes to a climax, and then the author's like, oh, by the way, here's how it started. And to me, that's anticlimactic a little bit. I get it that it's interesting to see the genesis of all the characters and so on. But I like the idea of doing a prequel now and then, you know, just propelling straight toward the end of the series. So we'll see. Hopefully readers will dial into that. And if not, The King will come out soon afterwards. So they'll at least be able to jump in the series with The King.
And that was going to be my next question, was basically why after book five did you decide to do a prequel instead of either doing it after The Bishop or after the series and doing it? But, you know, you kind of mentioned that this is when you felt the time of bringing out opening moves, and people will be able to get that beginning feeling before The Pawn. And if they haven't been able to read The Pawn, and maybe they jumped in at The Knight or they jumped in at The Bishop, that they can now go back and do The Pawn and The Rook after opening moves, and then the whole thing just kind of makes sense and comes together.
Yeah, it clicks together. And there are a lot of story threads and opening moves that will connect up with The King. In opening moves is where he first meets Basque, and then in The King he'll have a face-off with him. So even if you haven't read the others and you just say opening moves and then you read The King, the stories will make sense. So it'll follow from The Queen, also follow from opening moves. And so it's kind of exciting, the way to bring new readers in but also satisfy the faithful readers with some of the background on Bowers and how he came to be the expert that he is working with the FBI.
And now, you mentioned the pressure that you put upon yourself to keep putting out books and doing it all the time, and it makes it very difficult sometimes because you always have that extra added pressure. Now, when you started out and, you know, you were writing, how big of it, because we get a lot of authors that get very down on themselves when someone writes a bad review and someone puts something out there and they don't agree with it and this and that. Did you let that get to you at the beginning? Do you still let it get to you? Or are you just kind of like, you know what, I just can't let it bother me? How do you now handle people that might give you a bad review on one of your books?
Well, it's easy to get up and get down and let that stuff either make you feel good or make you feel bad. Of course, I love great reviews, and thankfully that's most of what we get. But occasionally, sure, you'll get someone who doesn't like a book, and maybe it's not their genre. They don't like it. And early on, sure enough, I would check reviews every day. I'd go through, and if there's a bad review, I would just be, no, what? No, you're kidding me.
Right.
You're an idiot. But at this point, I try not to read them. If it's a bad review, I don't usually read it. And like I said, thankfully, we haven't had too much trouble with that recently, and I'm just thankful and humbled by that. But I just try to focus on my book and say, you know, I'm glad when people love it, and if somebody doesn't like it, hey, you know, I feel like it's, you know, it's worth reading. It's a good read. And it doesn't trouble me so much anymore.
And now that writing is pretty much your full-time gig, and I know you do a lot of the speaking circuit, and I think that you still kind of teach and things, is what is a typical day like for you now, having to be on these massive deadlines to get your book out? What is a typical day for Stephen James here, you know, having to do and write?
You know, it's interesting. It's changed in the last month. I've been waking up early and writing for a couple of hours, maybe at 4. And I might write for 2 hours and then go back to bed for an hour, hour and a half. Then I get up and do some editing. Around lunch, I usually try and take a break and either get outside or exercise or something. And then in the late afternoon, type in some changes, and at night maybe flesh out some new ideas. So I kind of spread it out throughout the day, try to work maybe 2 or 3 hours and take a break. And it's sort of weird how it's happened, where I'll get up at 3 or 4 and work for a couple of hours and then just go back to bed for an hour. But it seems to be working. So for now, at least, that's what I'm doing.
And, you know, when you're talking to, when you do these events, because you're at Thriller Fest and you had a great thing that you put on, when you were talking about suspense writers and kind of the formula and the things of those nature. And it was great when you brought, I think it was the fox or the rabbit story that you put out. Now, is those kind of the things that you tell, you know, writers, that there really is no formula? It's just what you feel comfortable in doing. And, you know, because every writer is just so different in how they do their craft, basically.
Yeah, I really believe that formulas and the three-plot structure and the outlining and all that stuff can really handcuff a story. So I was really happy in Publishers Weekly review. They said Steve doesn't follow formula this month in the review, and I was so thrilled to see that. But when I write, I really try and listen to the story and watch the characters transform and watch them struggle to get through the process of solving the crime or catching the villain or whatever it might be. And so when I write, I continually ask myself, well, what would this character naturally do, and then how can I make things worse? And so I follow through trying to use escalation and believability. Those are two of the big keys, I think, for writing great stories, is escalation and believability.
So in writing The Queen, you know, since you've done a little bit of a different take on this Bauer series, and it kind of moves into a different direction, which was your most, I'm going to, two-part question, which was your most entertaining character in the book for yourself to write, and which was the most difficult to write once you started getting into the story?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a character in the story called named Alexei, who's an ex-Russian assassin, and he ends up being this really fascinating, complex character that you kind of like. Even though he's this killer, you end up liking him. So he's the most complex villain that I've come up with in any of the books. So he was intriguing to write, and I really came to like him. So he's probably the most interesting character in that way. And then what was the second part?
Which was kind of the most difficult, that once you started getting it and writing, it was just difficult, I guess, to just kind of, it was male or female. It's just a difficult character for you to either get your hands around or just to be able to, like, get it correct. It's just the most
fun,
maybe the most rewrites.
Yeah, Yeah, that's good. There's a female character who's a villain in this book, and she would probably be that person, because I wanted the most interesting one to be Alexi, and so I needed to make her frightening and formidable, but also maybe not as complex and fascinating. And so when you have these different layers of villains, where you have two or three or even four different ones, you have to be careful that they don't play the exact same role in the story. And so they each have a different level of status. They each have a different level of, I don't know, cold-heartedness or something. But each of them also you need to make as a foe that isn't easy to overcome. So balancing that out, especially with her, that was tough. That took me a lot of rewrites, to follow that through.
Now, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but I believe that Patrick Bauer's, the character, has been sold for, is it a TV deal?
Well, ABC Studios optioned the series, and we're still working out to see if we can pull off a pilot. But so it's still in the works. It's still in the works, and that's really kind of where things are. I was thrilled that they were so interested in the character that they optioned the series. So we'll have to see what happens. There's some stuff in play. I'll actually be following up with that in a couple weeks, meeting over with my agent in Hollywood.
So now, do you get involved a lot with that, or are you basically just to the point of when it sells and then the pilot maybe goes, that they just kind of let you go and they just able to take it however they want to?
Well, I did work on getting the pitch together to take it to the studios, but
okay.
I did not write the pilot. That was another author who wrote the pilot for the series, and so I'm not as involved. I would be a story consultant if everything works out with the series, but I wouldn't be out in Hollywood all the time. I, for me, it's really working on the next novel and developing that story, and I really don't have time to work on scripts. Although, if it played out, it sure would be fun to write a couple of them. I'd definitely have to try and do that.
Right, and you already knew when you were writing Patrick Bauer's that you were going to do these 7, now 8 books in the series. So you already had an idea of what you were going to do and how it was all going to be laid out when you first did it. How much that plan has changed?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I did have everything kind of all mapped out. But, truthfully, every book that I'm writing, I have an idea or a few ideas for, and then it just develops on its own. So I'm still working on the next scene and opening moves. As far as knowing exactly where that's going to go, I couldn't tell you. But my publisher has been really, really great to work with. Actually, I have two publishers for the series, and they've both been great because they've given me a lot of freedom to just develop the story as I see fit that I need to take it. Because of that, actually, each book really does have a fresh and different feel. They're not all exactly the same. So, it changes a lot. I'm very organic in the way that I write. I just continue to try and flesh out where the story's going and just be faithful to where it needs to go.
And now looking into the future, I guess, crystal ball kind of thing, when Patrick Bauer's finally, when you have Checkmate and it's coming out and now he's kind of gone for a while, what do you have planned, coming up into the future? I know you mentioned a little bit in Thriller Fest about something, but I don't know if that was what you were going to continue to do in the future. Is that still your plan?
Yeah, I'm about 75% done with a book that'll be a brand new series. And so before the Bauer series ends, if it does, which I think, but who knows what the future will hold. But anyway, so I figured I would start the new series and get some momentum with that. And who knows, maybe we'll do a spinoff. Patrick Bauer's stepdaughter is a pretty fascinating character, Tessa. And so, it's possible we might be able to do a spinoff book with her. People have already requested that. So who knows? Who knows what will happen? For me, that's a lot of the fun of doing this. You grab an idea and you flesh it out and you just play with it and toy with it for a few months or almost a year in some cases, and then you give it to readers, and then you work on the next idea. And, you know, if I knew too much ahead, I think I would get bored with what I do. As it is, it's every day it's interesting and fresh and exciting. And I wouldn't want to do anything else.
So besides Patrick Bowers and maybe besides Tessa, what are the emails you get the most of from fans that want to know more about a certain character in the Bowers series here?
Well, there's a character that appeared in The Pawn named Severin. And for a long time, people kept asking, you know, what happened with Severin and you know, is he going to come back? And I don't want to give too much away about the last few books, but I will say that in The Night, a new character was introduced named Giovanni, who is the bad guy. And man, he's pretty freaky. I think I've told you this before, but I was having nightmares when I wrote that book, and I had actually stopped writing it for a while, put it aside. So people are asking about Giovanni, when's he going to be back, and what's going to happen with his character. So it ends up always being the villain.
Well, and but that's the most, you know, those are the most intriguing ones. I think the villains, you know, the heroes maybe are why people continue to read the book because of the evolution, but the villains are the ones that actually make the book. Because if you have boring villains, it's just not an interesting, it just doesn't make for interesting, you know, read. Because everybody knows about the hero, but you have to keep changing up for the villain all the time, and I think that would be the most difficult for a writer like yourself to keep going, because you already know Patrick. There's not much change in him. It's the villain that has to keep changing and has to keep maneuvering him, because that's what makes him evolve further, whether it's killing a friend of his or a family member or whatever. That the villain is what makes him move along and how he's going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right, because I always tell people the strength of your protagonist or your hero is measured against what he has to overcome. And so if you don't have a formidable foe or a really frightening, you know, villain, he doesn't have to be very heroic. You know,
no.
He just has to overcome this case or whatever it is. And so you've got to come up with these characters that the reader and even the author in some cases are either frightened of or just you say, there's no way, how could he possibly stop this person? That's what you want. That's what creates those great, memorable stories.
I mean, let's just say, for instance, that, you know, Patrick's wife, you know, Tessa's mother, was killed by a crazy person. That would have been a whole different scenario of how Patrick and Tessa had to interact and how their lives would be changed, you know, going into the future if that maybe would have happened instead. You know, it was a little different. But that's how a villain can change the whole aspect of a character going forward. If, let's say, in The Queen, which, you know, Tessa ends up getting her head blown off, that'll change how Patrick goes along.
Well, I should say that she doesn't in The Queen get her head blown off.
No, she doesn't get 100 seconds, yeah.
But you're right, yes. I didn't want any readers to get mad at me. What?
Well, you know what? Maybe she does. You got to read the book to find out if she gets her head blown off. You know what? Or maybe she blows someone else's head off. That's the exciting thing about suspense thriller. Maybe someone's head does get blown off. You got to read it to find out.
Yeah, you definitely have to read it. That's for sure. So, but it's a good point, because I've struggled with if I wanted somebody really close to Patrick to end up being killed off. And, you know, it ends up almost a cliche in too many series where his wife or his girlfriend gets killed or his daughter or something like that. And so it's been difficult because, you, on the other hand, you want it to be personal. You really want whatever the villain does with this main character, this hero. It's got to be personal. It can't just be, you know, he's going to blow up New York City. He's got to blow up New York City. And guess what? Grandma lives in New York City or something
right.
like, you know. So it's got to be personal in some way. But also you have to avoid the cliches that it can bring. So it's always a struggle. And now with 5 books under my belt in this series, and every one of them has a major twist in it, I'm working on opening moves saying, all right, what's my twist going to be here? Because I can't use this kind of twist, can't do that kind of twist. Everyone will say, oh, that's the same as the rook, or that's the same as the bishop. So it does get harder with each book you do.
Well, 60 seconds left here, Stephen. Now, if you're going out and doing events and whatnot, what do you got coming up where people can go if they're in the area to meet you and maybe talk about, maybe get the book signed, whatever. What do you got coming up?
Well, you can go to stephenjames.net to see my full schedule, Stephen with a V. But I know I'll be in Texas, actually, coming up in a couple weeks at a writer's conference down in Texas. And then I'm doing some local things around here, and I think I'm going to be in New Mexico, but I'd have to look at the schedule. So, in Texas, and even if you can't make it to the whole conference, and stop by, and I'll sign your books and get you on your way.
So there you go. Stephen James, author of The Queen, the fifth book in the Patrick Bauer series, stephenjames.net. You can find all the information. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. We have to stay in touch more. And, you know, I really appreciate you coming on today.
Hey, it's been great to be here. Anytime, just give me a shout, John.
All right, Stephen, have a good one. And it looks like you're about nap time for another hour before you get back up in New York, a couple more hours of opening moves. So go do that.
Well, I'm going to go grab some coffee and get at it a little bit. Thanks, John. See ya.
There you go. All right, have a good one. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, everybody, that was author Stephen James. You can find him at Stephen, S-T-E-V-E-N, James.net to do all the information that you want to know about his latest book, The Queen, which we have said, you know, is probably the best here in the Patrick Bauer series, which was a hard task to follow, seeing as how we made The Bishop at the best book of 2010 in the Patrick Bauer series. All of them, if you haven't read them yet, it's one of those things where you can read The Queen, go back and catch up on the other ones. He's going to bring you opening moves, and that's going to be interesting to come when that comes out. So, again, stephenjames.net. The book is The Queen. It is out, fifth book, Patrick Bauer series. Go check it out. We are going to take a little break before we have our next guest coming on, which is Andrea Creamer, to talk about her latest adventure, which is her Nightshade series here in Wolfsbane. And it's a young adult, it's a young adult fantasy, you know, werewolf kind of series, and we're going to get into that with her. So we'll be back here in about 5 minutes. Take a listen.
again.
So we are back, ladies and gentlemen, and I want to thank you so much again for our last guest, Stephen James, author of The Queen. We are going to be joined here in about 15, 20 seconds with our next author, Andrea Creamer, to talk about her latest book, which is called Wolfbane, which is the second in her series. The first one was called Nightshade. Like I said, it's a it's her YA, it's her young adult series. I'm not a real fan of when they call it young adult because, you know, I still read comic books. I still love, you know, those types of stories, and I know that they write them more for the, you know, for the teenager, which is great. But if you're an adult and you know a good story is a good story no matter what. So don't let the YA fool you with anything, especially when, you know, people like to put that moniker on things. So I want to thank so much, Andrea, for joining us today. So, Andrea, how are you doing? And thanks so much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I have to say, I was thrilled to say to hear that you like comics, too. I'm a huge comic book fan.
Yes.
So that's a genre that doesn't matter what your age is. It's always fabulous.
Yeah, and just between you and me, I mean, I just ordered 15 Batman comics to catch up on my series. So don't let my wife know because she might get mad.
I won't say anything.
I'm a huge Batman fan, and of course my goal is to get every, you know, all 713, which is going to be very difficult, but, you know, you just do what you got to do. You got Batman 1 coming, and that's going to be a hard one to snag.
That is true. It's a noble goal, though. I admire the goal.
It is. So, knowing that you're a comics fan, like I said, I think that when people put the moniker of the YA on there, I think it drives adults away because they think it's going to be too childish and kiddish, and just because the books might be about teenagers and things like that, a good story is a good story, and it doesn't mean that only teenagers should read this. I mean, you had a lot of adults reading the Twilight series and things like that, even though they're YA books. And your latest book is Wolfbane, which
yes.
is the sequel to Nightshade. So kind of give us an idea of a behind the scenes here of the characters and, you know, what made you go ahead and kind of jump into this kind of genre.
Yeah, well, I think you made a great point about the label YA, and I think labels in general are very misleading for a lot of books, and it's done for marketing purposes and to help people kind of understand what the book is, the main audience is intended to be. But with YA, it's very, very tricky because YA is primarily assigned that category simply due to the age of the protagonist, so the main characters. And mm-hmm. and my main character's name is Calla, and Calla is 17 years old. She's on the cusp of becoming 18, and on her 18th birthday, she will be taking over as the alpha female of a wolf pack. And so I write about werewolves, but I actually only use that as another label that I think is very misleading, because one of the reasons I wrote Nightshade was I wanted to portray wolves as I saw them, not as half man, half beast. It takes 10 minutes to transform and bones are breaking and everything.
Right.
I really wanted to create a mythology where wolves were strong and powerful, and the ability to shift form was something that was considered a benefit, not a disease or a curse. And so Calla is in a position that she's always expected. She was raised to be an alpha, and she will be mated to the alpha male, who's also coming of age of a rival pack, because the guardians, as I call them, my werewolves, are fighting in the front lines of a war that's been going on between two factions of witches since the Middle Ages. So it's an action-packed book that also has a love story that undergirds what's happening, because it's very much about coming of age. But I think that to categorize young adult books as being, you know, written in a less mature language or not having depth in theme or nuanced ideas flowing through them, it really isn't the case. I think some of the best writing that's out there right now is being written in the YA genre, and that's why you have such a kind of a swell of audience that is coming into it, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, I think that the YA genre is definitely one of the most popular ones out there right now. I think it's growing the fastest, especially, you know, with the you know, whether it's the vampire, the, you know, the werewolves, or those types of, I guess, characters. Now, mm-hmm. when you decided to develop, you know, your werewolves, did you read a lot of werewolf lore or any kinds of things like that you did a lot of research on? Or did you just kind of do it, you know, on your own, and you just kind of went your own way?
I mostly went my own way, and it very much had to do with the fact that I'm a small-town girl. I was born and raised, actually I was born somewhere else, but I was raised and did all my schooling in a tiny, tiny town in northern Wisconsin that is surrounded by a national forest. And so I spent, rather than being inside playing with Barbies all day, I was out in the woods every day building forts and exploring. And I loved not only the woods, but also all of the wildlife that was in them. And so I preferred watching National Geographic and Discovery Channel to cartoons. So I knew wolves really well. They were my favorite animals. And so for me, when I had been encountering werewolf stories, because I love paranormal and I love fantasy, so I would run into a lot of different versions of lycanthropes all throughout the books that I was just eating up. And they never rang true for me because, like I said earlier, I thought wolves were incredible animals. And when I imagined, as I often did, being able to change into another animal, the idea of being able to change into a wolf, I always thought, heck yes. And all the werewolves I was reading about either didn't know that they were changing and then were lamenting the fact that they'd eaten their best friend the night before, or were, you know, basically just these horrible, evil creatures. And so I really wanted to try to do something different and ground it in the way I thought wolves actually behave in the wilderness, and the fact that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, so much about books is about relationships with family, with a lover, with rivals and enemies, and wolves have all of that in their pack relationships. So it just really lent itself to exploring hierarchies.
Yeah, that is so true that, you know, that wolves are definitely, and I guess they're probably one of the most, not really, I don't want to say intriguing, they're probably one of the most misunderstood animals. Because I used to live in Minnesota, like we talked about, you lived in northern Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. wolves are very timid creatures when it comes to humans. They don't want to be around people.
Yeah, it's really hard to see one.
Yeah. It's like coyotes out here in Southern California. You see a coyote running around, people freak out. Believe me, that coyote, if he sees you, if he could literally pee on the ground, he would. He's so scared.
Yes,
and that's what he
absolutely.
Would do. And that's why people don't see wolves. They don't come out hunting people. So mm-mm. that's what makes it very difficult for when you're, you know, to get over that mystique, which is why they always try to do the shark weeks and whatnot, of how animals really truly are. And that's what you're trying to bring in. And you're just doing it in a different way.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to get across.
And, you know, that's what makes it, you know, very interesting. You just decide to put it into a YA part, which, again, it's not a book that you have to read if you're, you know, if you're thinking that you're, you know, 40 years old like myself, 41. I would love to read it. I would read a YA. I don't care if it's YA. A good story is a good story. And, you know, just because you put it in, you know, a younger main character or protagonist, whatever they like to say, doesn't make a difference. And so you moved a little bit from Wolfbane into Nightshade. And how has that progression taken it? Has it taken it in a way that you thought it was going to do? Has it changed now that when Blood Rose comes out in February, which is the third book, has that all of a sudden been blown up into a different way? Give us that little background.
Well, the way that I write is really strange in that I don't write in chronological order. I have scenes that come to me, so I know the big story before I know how the main characters are going to get from the very first scene to the conclusion of the series. And when I began to write Nightshade, I knew it was three books. I knew that the story would take three books to tell. Fortunately, I was a naive debut author who had an agent who loved it immediately, and my editor loved it immediately, because you're not supposed to go in and say, I have three books, when you're completely unknown. But it all fell into place. So I knew how Blood Rose was going to end as I was writing Nightshade. The way that events came together and the twists and turns that have happened that carry the characters from one book to another have definitely evolved. You know, writers often say that their characters surprise them, which sounds crazy because, you know, you're the author, but it's absolutely true. I am shocked by some of the things that my characters do, but that's one of the joys of creating a novel. The other thing about my trilogy is that I don't leave time between the events of each book. I really almost see it as one 1,500-page book instead of three, 400 to 500-page books. So the action of each book picks up exactly where the last book leaves off, and that's why I am known for actually writing very, very wicked cliffhangers, because I am really brutal about
idea.
It and hang on to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea, and I want to let people know that you have two websites. One for your author is Andrea Creamer. Now, is it Creamer? C-R-E-M-E-R?
It's pronounced Kramer, but it's spelled C-R-E-M-E-R.
Kramer. Okay.
Yeah.
So Andrea Creamer, C-R-E-M-E-R.com, and then you have another book, another site, which is nightshadebook.com, which kind of delves all the way into the three books here, which is Nightshade, Wolfbane, and then they have, you know, Blood Rose coming up because it is coming up in February. And that's a very interesting, you know, way to do it. A lot of people don't do it that way. Was that your idea on the, you know, because everybody's looking for new marketing strategies and new ways to do these things. So was that something that you decided to create to have these two totally separate, you know, websites away from each other?
Well, the author site is my personal site, so it delves into a variety of projects, but Penguin and I talked extensively about how the books would be marketed, and they wanted to create a website that was dedicated just to the series, and I do think that the series needs its own attention, and we also wanted to create specific content so that readers could go further into the world of Nightshade. One of the things that was really unique about the marketing campaign that led up to the release of the first book was we worked with Campfire New York City, which is a marketing campaign that specializes in creating alternate worlds, and there was a series of videos featuring Shay, who is one of the main characters, one of the main male characters of the book, and his story is he has just moved to Vail to live in his uncle's house, and his uncle is a very strange man with a very strange house, and he doesn't realize that he's been thrown right into the middle of this war between witches, and also that there are werewolves fighting in that war, and they're going to school with him. And so he's trying to uncover the mystery of why there are such strange things going on. And that actually became an entire story in and of itself that we used webisodes to broadcast, as well as a blog, and audience members in real time were able to solve puzzles along with the character leading up to the release of the book. And there also is a free e-novella that you can get on the nightshadebook.com website about what that, you know, what that prequel is.
Right, and that is the glorious, beautiful part, everybody. I'm going to tell you that ebooks are the greatest way to do it, because now, instead of having to wait, you can put out an excerpt, or you can put out a 40-page, you know, little novella, little short story to tie some things together, and it can go out right away, instead of how many authors before there was ebooks were able to do those things, able to tie those things up and move those things along. The invention of ebooks being able to let you do that, and you've taken full advantage of that, which is extremely smart.
Oh, thanks. No, I absolutely loved it. And what I there will be, I think, more ebooks in the future to kind of create these ties between different parts of the story, because Kel is the main character, and she's the narrator of all three books, and there are other characters who there lots of different things are going on in their lives, and so having e-novellas available in between the print books allows you to explore the other perspectives, the other voices, the other events that are happening in the world in a way that I think, yeah, you're right. You absolutely can't write all of those things and print all of those things that, you know, in a way that, you know, kind of gives immediate access to readers. And I think that the digital content is only going to get better and better, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, because there's just some things that you just can't put into the stories that, because they just really don't fit,
yes,
but they need to be tied up, and you don't want to take away from the story. So why not bring out an ebook, you know, 20, 30, 40 pages or whatever, and tie those things up and put them together? And
yeah,
that's what they, and that's what people are able to do now with ebooks. And I think that that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I think there's going to be some really, really cool interactive content that becomes available because of the rise in digital print. Is that an oxymoron, digital print?
Yeah, because Barnes & Noble is going to be the next one to go down. I'm just telling
people
now.
I don't want to say it. I don't want to hear that.
I'm going to give it 18 to 24 months before Barnes & Noble will have the same problem that Borders had, and that's what they're going to see. Unfortunately, you know, I mean, like I tell people, you try to buy a CD. try to buy a CD that's not from a, you know, very popular group. You know, you can find the AC/DCs and the things like that. But go into Best Buy and see how many CDs they have left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? When it was first opened, that store was everywhere. I mean, CDs were everywhere. You had them all over the place. Why, when you can just, and I always tell people, what's the difference of taking your iPod and buying it straight off of Amazon and downloading it to your iPod and walking around and listening to it than going out and buying the CD? Same music. So what's mm-hmm. the difference of buying a print book to buying the e-book? Same book, same thing, nothing changed. But people have that mystique that they have to hold it in their hand. And I think that's the stupidest argument I've ever heard in my entire life. Of why they need print. I just like the feel of it. I like to hold it. I like the smell of it. You know what? Then buy Febreze and make your house smell like books and read
they
a freaking e-book.
Books. I love that. They should have book smell because I actually am one of those people who love the smell of books.
Right. They should
so
have
they make
books
a book home fragrance spray. That would be awesome.
Right. It's like new car smell, all right? I like my new car smell for the first 2 weeks. I don't want my car to smell like new car smell all the time. That would get on my nerves. You know, so that argument that people have to hold it and feel it and touch it and whatnot, give me a break. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. It is. You know, I can understand if the e-book is different than the printed book, then you have an argument. But you have no argument for me from an e-book to a print book. Let's make it electronic. Let's get it into your hand. It's cheaper. It's faster. It's more accessible. And you can hold 3,000 books on a Kindle or a Nook or a Sony e-reader, whatever you read, and I think it's great. So... But speaking of innovation, and I wanted to know if this was something that you thought of doing, because now that you have your website, nightshadebook.com, to go mm-hmm. along with your regular one, Andrea Kramer, CREMER.com, were you ever going to kind of come out with maybe its own Facebook page of Kala and kind of maybe have people interact with her in a way that she becomes more real to them? Because that's a very important thing.
Yes. No, that there is actually a Facebook page for Shay Doran, and that's spelled S-H-A-Y, and his last name is D-O-R-A-N. And you can you can go visit that, and you see the live interactions with him, and that's where a lot of book updates are posted. And it's also become a forum for fans to discuss the book and answer each other's questions. And it's a great Facebook site. I do believe that, to me, the characters are very real. And so the reason that Shay has a Facebook page is not only because it tied into the marketing and created a site where people could post and interact regarding the puzzles, but also because in Shay's position in the world, he was the only character who would have had a Facebook page, because Kala and her pack have to keep their identities very closed to the outside world, and they also are their primary role in life is their duty as warriors. So they're very limited, and like they wouldn't be able to do the social networking. They would get in trouble for it. So they do lots of socializing with each other, and they would hang out and play Xbox and stuff, but it would be considered much too dangerous for her to be that public. And then particularly with the events that happen in Wolfsbane and then in Bloodrose, she just like no time to even look at a computer. So that's kind of the situation that they're in. It just wouldn't be realistic for her to be in a position. So that's why Shay is the one who has a Facebook page.
I gotcha. Now, do you... Seeing as how Nightshade came out, and you know, I'm sure you're very nervous, like a new author is when the books kind of come out, new series, new thing. But it came out and it did so, you know, such a good job on the market. That do you feel now that you should not have maybe limited yourself? And I don't know if you have. Maybe you've changed your mind to where there's going to be more than you know, Bloodrose, because I see that there's an Entitled book coming down the future. So have you already started to go beyond the three books, and it's going to be more than that now with Kala and her clan?
Well, I'm very, very committed to not continuing a story simply because the series is going well. Because to me, the story is what the story is, and if there were more to tell, I would definitely write more books. There very well could be more books set in the Nightshade world, because they're like you mentioned, the prequel, which is coming out in fall 2012, is about the origins of the Witches' War. So it features knights and religious sects and all sorts of, and that was sects, S-E-C-T-S, just in case I've shocked anyone.
Right.
and controversy and conspiracy set in the Middle Ages about how this war first began and where the Guardians come from. And then there are, because, you know, the history of this war is so long, there are many, many episodes along the way that I could see either being standalones or series on their own. And there are other books that could continue into the future, but I think that they would likely focus on different characters, just because I feel that Kala's story, right now at least, I feel very much was a trilogy. And that could change. But I my gut is telling me that cycle is true. It's what it is, and I wouldn't want to try to manipulate it to change that. And I also have there are other series that I really want to write that are also fantasy, but set in different places and with new characters. So I definitely want to make sure that I'm writing all the stories that are in me and not pursuing just one line of characters, because I do think, if you're, like you said with Rye, with all books, is that a good story is a good story. So I hope that the readers who love Kala and her world will also come along with me to check out a different world with new characters as well.
And when people get the book, and so Wolfbane here is the second one, and they weren't familiar with Nightshade, do you recommend them going back and reading Nightshade first, or can they just jump right in here with Wolfbane and then go back and then go ahead and go Blood Road? How do you tell readers that they should probably read the books?
I would highly recommend reading them in order because there is so much, a lot of the suspense that exists in the world of Nightshade is about Kala and her pack and her friends trying to figure out what they've been told in their lives is true and what's a lie. And so understanding how the world is put together and what the rules are and why she's trying to make the choices that she is, that's all set up in Nightshade. And I think jumping into, I have definitely had reviewers and readers who started with Wolfsbane, loved it, and then went back and read Nightshade. But you're going to have to give yourself patience to catch up, because there is so much that happened in the first book in terms of establishing the rules of the world. And unlike a lot of paranormal books where it's a human person who gets swept up into a magical world and is told how everything works, this is a story where the main character is a leader in the fantasy world already. So you're really just thrown into it, immersed, and there isn't a spoon feeding of backstory. And I did that purposefully in writing. So it's one of those things where I think that readers who go into Wolfsbane, there's a little bit of catch up and a little bit of flashback that goes on to set the context of what's happening. But most readers, I would say, would be better off reading Nightshade first.
So, yeah, and a lot of people, you know, like to read those things in order, which is good. And seeing as how maybe it is only a trilogy, it's nothing that is going to be too difficult, because some people are like, and you know, they never knew who Jan Ivanovich was, and they see book 18, and they're like, oh, my God, I got to go back and read book one, and then they just kind of stop. But, you know, with trilogies, it's a little different, which is good. So, you know, that's a good thing to know, that you kind of wrote it on the fact, you know, a lot of people say, oh, no, it's a standalone. You can read them whatever. I've never been a big fan of, if you have a character going, I think you should probably start at the beginning to understand things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
mm-hmm.
good. So you pretty much wrote it exactly to be read in order to understand the true story of what's going on.
Absolutely.
So now, you know, seeing as how you're in the second book, we got about 60 seconds left. Tell people, you know, where are you going to be at? You're going to be on events? You're going to be on book signing tours? You know, where can they maybe, you know, contact you, and, you know, can they get autographed books from you and things like that? Where are you going to be out in the public?
I am going to be out in the public quite a bit. I will be at the Austin Teen Book Festival the first weekend of October. I will also be at the Minnesota Booksellers Association meeting in September, and at the Y'all Fest, which is in Charleston, South Carolina, in November 11th. I'm going on my first European tour, so if anybody listening in Italy or France, I will be there right around Halloween. And then I'm doing a full tour in February and March for the release of Blood Rose. So I post all of my events up on my blog and on Facebook, so people can follow me there. I have a public Facebook page, so people can friend me. And I also, my email is andreakramerwrites@gmail.com. And I'm always happy to get you. I get lots and lots of emails. I'm always happy to get them.
wonderful. Well, Andrea, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure. You know, we have to come back in February to wrap the whole thing up here. You know, with the Blood Rose, we have to, you know, wrap that whole thing up coming up in February.
Love that.
So that would be great. All right. Well, enjoy yourself. I know you have a very busy day going on today. And you know, go Gophers, right?
Yes, go Gophers. Good luck.
Exactly.
All right,
so we will talk with you soon. Thanks so much.
All right, thanks.
All right. So again, everybody, that was Andrea Kramer, CREMER.com. You can also go to nightshadebook.com to find out a lot more and delve into a lot more into the series here of Nightshade, Wolfsbane, and Blood Rose, the trilogy of Kala Tor and, you know, her story about what's going on in her clan and the whole stuff that's going on, a brand new twist that Andrea's been able to put on. So you want to go check that out. We are going to be back here in just a minute with Rick Mofina, and we're going to be talking about his latest book and the stuff that he's been doing. So in the meantime, you're going to have to listen to something, and here you go. We are back, and I want to thank everybody for staying with us here on this extended edition we have of Suspense Radio, and we are going to be bringing on our next guest, a good friend of ours here, Rick Mofina, is going to be talking about his latest book, In Desperation, but he's also done an exclusive little ebook too. You can find him at rickmofina.com, M-O-F-I-N-A.com, and all the work that he's done, because Rick's been at it for quite some time, writing killer books. No pun intended. So, Rick, how you doing? Nice to see you again.
I'm doing fine. Thanks very much for having me, John. Pleasure to be on.
Yes. Hey, so, In Desperation, your latest one, tell everybody a little bit about the behind the scenes here of In Desperation.
Well, In Desperation is part of the Jack Gannon series. Jack Gannon's a crime reporter with the International Wire Service based in Manhattan. I'm a former crime reporter, and I used to work with a wire service. So so I sort of drawn what I know on my experiences. And the book Stand Alone, the book is the third in the series. It was launched with Vengeance Road and followed up with The Panic Zone. And it follows the exploits of a bit of a loner. I mean, he's the classical, you know, PI structure. He's on his own. You know, he had a hard upbringing, blue-collar kid from Buffalo, New York, and his dream was to work for a global wire service, so the country and the world is his beat, and he goes and investigates and, you know, seeks to restore order to the chaos, as it were.
Is that really a good idea to bring order to chaos? Don't we all love chaos when we're reading our books? Maybe not in our lives we like chaos, but we love chaos when reading. I think that makes it interesting.
Well, I think you know, in news, we thrive on it. I suppose we thrive on the chaos. I mean, it does feed the fire and gets our adrenaline going. And, you know, to answer what In Desperation's about, I mean, Jack has always wondered about his sister. They're estranged. His long-lost sister was a guiding light. She's older than he was and had encouraged him to follow his dream. But she disappeared, just walked out on the family when she was a troubled teenage girl, a young woman, and he never, ever saw her again. And in desperation, they do come together and deal with a life-and-death situation and come to terms with their own strained family relationship, which I thought was a good skeleton for the book, a good spine to hang the book on.
Well, and if people aren't familiar here with Jack Gannon, like you said, this is a series, and this is the third book, In Desperation, where you start out with Vengeance Road and then The Panic Zone. Now, did you know when you started out writing Vengeance Road for Jack Gannon that you were going to be up to three books? Is that something you anticipated? Did you have an ending of when you thought that maybe, you know, I'm only going to do four or five, and then I'm going to move on to something else? Because you do have a couple other series that you always work on, which is Jason Wade and the Reed Sydowski series that you've also kind of got going here in the works. What was your plan for Jack Gannon kind of starting out?
Well, Gannon is simply, John, simply an ongoing series. It was planned to be that, a series, as it were. There was the overarching storyline of the sister and the estrangement, but it was ongoing in that each book could be like a standalone. I was comfortable with that. The publisher was comfortable with that. So in a way, it's a continuing character where there is some story thread, and I don't want to downplay it for the purists. But you can come to any book at any point and be totally up to speed with things, really. The other series, I would say that Tom Reed and Walt Sadowski out of San Francisco, they're on hiatus, as it were, and the Jason Wade trilogy, as it is, pretty much ended there, although it's doing well in the UK, so you never know. The books are just the Jason Wade trilogy, which is a rookie reporter out of Seattle, is gaining a lot of attention in the UK, so we'll see what happens there. Gannon I do like the fact that the country and the world is his beat. I still stay in touch with a lot of reporter friends, and you know there's a lot of people who are doing well as crime fiction authors who come from the tradition of news reporting. I mean, it's a separate nation unto ourselves, as it were, and goes back a long way. I mean, for generations, many great writers have come from that tradition. So I enjoy it. I do like telling those stories. But what the publishers and I have also are comfortable with is I can do standalones too, and that gives me a chance to try something a little different.
Well, speaking of something a little different, you did do something a little different with your exclusive ebook only here called Dangerous Women and Desperate Men. I do believe that the desperate men part is so true. in more ways than one. But that is something that's a little bit, because you did, you know, four short stories, like you said, of people on the brink, and you decided to bring this out as an ebook exclusive only. Now, what was your reasoning behind doing something like this? Was it, and I'm just going to guess, and maybe I'm way off base, was it to write four short stories and kind of see if one of them held a lot of water to be able to take maybe that character or that story and continue it on into another way? Or did you just have four short stories that you wanted to just get out and you felt this was the best way to do it?
Well, you're kind of right on all fronts, John. Well, these stories were written over a number of years, and I truly believed in them and loved them. I thought they're excellent examples of work, little jewels, if you will. Lightning Rider, the first story, had won the Arthur Ellis Award in Canada. It was published in Michael Connelly's collection, Murder in Vegas, and some other anthologies had picked it up. The story As Long as We Both Shall Live, which was also shortlisted for an award, was done in a format that I thought was experimental for me, in the format of a court transcript. Blood Red Rings is a very short, tight piece, which I thought I really hit the right notes. I really loved that story. Three Bullets to Queensland was an entirely different one, kind of cut from the same cloth as Blood Red Rings, but a different one again. So I believed wholeheartedly in these stories, and you know, after they're published and they're in anthologies, you know, not really doing too much. And with the advent, as we're sort of in the midst of a revolution, you know, in the publishing world, everyone's well aware of it. I also thought it would be a good chance for me, like many other authors, to get my toe into the EPUB waters and learn the ropes, as it were, and give it a try. I'm happy with my current legacy publishing situation. No qualms about it, but things are changing around us, and I just wanted to be aware. I mean, I follow Joe Conrath's blog and his prophecies, and you see the experiences of other authors. So it was a combination of those factors that I thought I had a really good product, and I also have some other stories I may try again. So we're just launching, just now as we speak, this little collection, this e-collection. I had a small business plan on it, a very informal business plan, to give it a try, make a small investment, because I really believed in the work. So I'll do what I can to bring it out, and I thank you for allowing me to speak about it. I really think people will enjoy these stories. These are acclaimed stories. I put a lot into them. They weren't something I just pounded out to offer up. These were stories that I bled for, as it were.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's very interesting when you said, because you decided to just go ahead and bring this out. Do you get any pushback from your publisher saying, no, I don't want you to do this? Or were they behind it and said, yeah, go ahead, because that's not something that we're going to do anyway, so good luck in doing it? I guess as long as it doesn't take away from, you know, your Jack Gannon series or do anything like that, you know, was there any kind of pushback at all?
No, on the contrary, I mean, I alerted them to what I was doing, and I told them I wanted to also include in my collection, where I could, the actual covers from my existing e-books that they published, and excerpts as well. And it was all win-win in that sense. And they just sent me the formality of the permissions to sign, the waivers to sign that I could do this. And I alerted them to the fact when it came out, and I hadn't had any pushback on that sense. And even the covers, which were designed by my friend John Holt, they were... you know, I meant to be consistent so at least that people could recognize my name on them. It's a rather unique name. But, no, the short answer is no real pushback. And, you know, who knows? Maybe they might want to see about bringing out a thin collection sometime down the road. But anthologies are different, as you know. And I was happy to give this one a try. And I'm really pleased with what we've got and what we've got to offer. So, you know, and we're in the infancy right now, so we'll see where it goes.
And, you know, speaking of those types of things, when you have these, you know, series that you got Jack Gannon, and, you know, and there's all, you know, when you write a book like you did In Desperation, which is out and people can go and buy it, e-book, wherever they're sold, is you always get that sense that you're probably, you know, you can only put so much in a story before, you know, it starts to either get a little dry or you're just putting in way too much fluff and things like that. But things that authors think need to be told in order to have the characters be evolved and be understood more. So now with the inception of e-books, you're able to do those things. And if you've started to think about how to kind of evolve your characters and like these little novellas and tie those things in together that you don't have to do in the book, where the book now can be just straight out action, this and that, and you can kind of leave some of that fluff to the other side to where, you know, people are interested in wanting to know more, they can be able to know more.
Well, I understand that point. I see what you're getting at. for me, I guess I'm too new to it all to see that, you know, you can really come at it from a different perspective. I think what does happen, John, is that, as we know, and I've seen this just coming up, that it cuts the delivery time. I mean, my stories were written a while ago, and we did have to get them formatted, get the covers made. But for those who are coming up and you have a good product and you're ready to go, the delivery time is really instantaneous. I mean, from the time I draft in the traditional format, we go through legacy. I mean, from the time I draft an outline and we get the green light, and then I draft the story, and then you go through production, it can be 18 months. But by the time you finish your work and you're ready to go you can go up, you know, the time limit is really up to you. I mean, you can really be up seriously within a couple of weeks, and off you go from the time you type the end to the time someone clicks purchase within weeks. That's faster than, as you know, with magazines and almost on a par with newspapers. I mean, it's instantaneous. So I think what you get is an instant interaction. Instant is a relative term, but relatively instant given the centuries-old tradition of publishing, with the reader, which is the aim. You know, you want to reach the reader with a good product, so this new format allows you to do that. So it's experimental for me, but one thing that I adhere to is it has to have depth. I mean, everyone, it's a cliche, but the story is everything that matters. It's paramount in the whole enterprise, but it gives you a chance to experiment. That for sure. To come back on your point, John, you certainly do have every opportunity to experiment because you've reduced the time. You can try with a novella, you can try with a story, you can switch genres quite quickly, and if you're okay with the publisher's okay with it, off you go. So it gives you a chance to put something out there right away and see if there's an appetite for it.
Sure, and you know that's the other inception that you've kind of done, because now you're starting to do your Facebook. You're getting your Facebook up. You've still not accepted my friend request, which I'm a little upset about.
I did. But, I did. I'll try to. We'll take care of
but,
that.
You know, but you're starting to do that, and it is changing. And we've talked about this before. You know, the changing, ever-changing world of how publishing, and now how an author has to be a marketer, and all these different things, and I think that it's an exciting time, but I think it's a scary time, you know,
exactly.
And you know, how do you view that? Yeah, because you started in writing before any of this stuff was ever out there. And
well,
now
you know,
I'm
sorry to interrupt you. You hit it right on the head. I'm in the throes of writing a blog piece right now on this very thing. It's a look back, the fear and loathing on the publishing trail, the confessions of a mid-lister. And, you know, my very first story was written in cursive handwriting in grade school. There was no such thing as the Internet. And when I have to say, John, that when Dangerous Women, Desperate Men went up for sale, it was very – I got a bit misty-eyed by thinking, like, you know, here I am e-publishing. I went back to as a kid, you know, writing things out in longhand, discovering Writer magazine. Back then it was at Boston. And snail mailing my little manuscripts off, waiting forever to get a response. I mean, it was glacial back then. I mean, we were in a different era. And now, I mean, I thought to myself, here I am in a new era, and it's scary and it's exciting at the same time. You know, it truly is, and things are changing so fast.
Well, the funny thing that you mentioned is that, you know, still a lot of publishers still do that. They still want that snail mail, you know, manuscript in the mail, which I don't understand why they, not all of them, like, you know, have just went to just the email and just taking in their email, but a lot of them still want that, you know, manuscript sitting there and in their hand in the paper form, and I guess it's maybe easier for them to do. But, yeah, you're from the line where, you know, you had to do all that. So now how have you progressed into the new age? Because now you've had to thrust yourself out in the front where people might not have seen your picture, didn't know who you were, you know, and anything like that, behind the scenes. How have you handled that?
Well, you do the best that you can. I mean, everything, you know, we're all human, and you can only do what's humanly possible. Everyone has a different personal situation, so you are you have to work within the constraints of your own personal situation, your financial situation, your time situation, your career situation. I mean, not everyone can go off to conferences, not everyone can do everything. So what you do is, I say, to people that when we discuss this very thing is, I mean, focus number one is producing that you have a solid product to offer, and that's what it is. It's a product because you put a price tag on it. Even the free stuff that you might offer as a loss leader for a time is still a product. It's got your name on it, so you better stand by it just like you would on anything else in the commercial world that you would go downtown to buy or at a mall to buy. You want that product to be worth the money you're going to put up for it. So number one is focus on product. Number two is making sure people know about that product. Work with your publisher, work with yourself on the best and most effective way you can do that. And the rest is out of your control. Joe and I agree, a lot of luck comes into play. I've had agents and editors tell me that sometimes it's just a matter of stars aligning the right way. Superb books might not get noticed. Excellent books might have a short lifetime. Books that are, some people might have trouble with become fabulous successes. Well, they become successes for one reason or another, but a lot of the times it's out of everyone's control. So I think you do your best and enjoy the ride, I think. If you're part of it and you don't get too stressed out about it, you do the best that you can.
Now, the one thing that we're asking a lot of established authors like yourself, because a lot of new authors always contact us and they want to know, and they have a lot of different questions about certain things. And the one thing that they get extremely upset about and they don't seem to be able to hold their emotions very well are like a negative review of their first book or somebody says something bad about it, and they get all worked up, and I try to tell them, just relax. I mean, just don't take one bad thing over 100 good things and let that one bad thing get on your nerves. How is that something that you handle today, looking back way back when and now looking at it today? If someone were to write you and say, I can't stand that book or whatever, or blah, 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 or they say something bad, what do you do? I mean, how do you handle that? How do you put it in perspective?
I laugh because sometimes I don't handle it very well. But I have over the years. I mean, I used to want to get pretty testy and get back. And when I used to review books way, way back before I was published, I was quite sharp and critical. And I remember a book editor who took the review said, just remember there are real people at the other end of the line. And I was of the view that authors were gods. They were published. They had big deals. So, you know, whatever I said from my little podium really couldn't hurt them. If I loved the book, and if I didn't like a book, I would tear it apart. And then it was my turn when my books went out there, and I was getting all kinds of reaction, including the stuff that said, your work sucks, really. And over the years, you learn to, you take the 24-hour rule, in my case, and sort of cool down, and if you want to respond, I think positively, and I've turned negative reviews into I've contacted the reviewer or people who've written to me and turned things around, engaged in a conversation. But when the review is bang on, I mean, if they've noticed a weakness and you say, geez, you know, they're right, you have a little respect for that. Of course you want everyone to love your work, but, you got to take everything with a grain. People who say your stuff's fabulous, that's wonderful. I mean, I have to say, John, that people who get it for what it is you're trying to provide is a good story, and you get a lovely review online or an email sent to you that, and a person got it. What you were trying to do is just enjoyed a good thrill and it made their weekend, and they thank you for it, and you thank them. That's really what you hope is what you're trying to achieve. You know, if they invested their $10. And they felt they got their money's worth. And then you get those who quibble, I found a typo, oh, this doesn't work, that doesn't work. That's
right.
Fine, too. I really think people are entitled, because once you put it out there, you are out there, and you're subject to anything that comes back, because it's a commercial enterprise. There's a dollar sign on it. People have paid, and they're entitled to say whatever they like. But then you got to qualify and quantify and characterize where it goes. I don't write first person, and when someone says, I prefer first person books, so your book sucks, I mean, you know, I'm not walking to, say, an Indian restaurant and say, because I don't like Indian food, the food is bad. It just
right.
doesn't make sense. So you just sort of qualify. But if someone says, look, this character was a little weak here, or you didn't pick up on this thread, and you go, you know what, they may be right, we may have missed that, and that happens. And it happens to all authors. The way to handle it is really roll with it. Because for every bad review, you're going to get a good review. And then you'll know in your heart the author will know in their heart of hearts when someone is right and when someone's off base. And when they're right, it may hurt because, well, that was a weakness, and you learn from them. So there's that. But focus on the writing. Focus on doing what you want to do and making it better each time out. And you look at these punches that you get, the punches and the bouquets, and they all go to make you better.
Now, you did bring something up just now that I thought was interesting, and your books are layered to where when you're reading them, you kind of have a layer upon a layer upon a layer, and then when you're kind of getting down to the end, you're kind of having to peel all that back. Now, it's very easy to maybe forget something that because you do have so many things going on, and you can get that and say, oh, I forgot to go back to that or this and that. Do you feel that when you're writing that you have to keep going back and back and rereading and rereading to make sure that those things don't happen?
Absolutely. I work on it. The editors work on it because we're making constant changes at different points in the story to make it better. And so you want to make sure that you go back and check all the bolts and hinges and everything and make sure everything is still in place and works, because it's easy to make some changes along the line and realize that you've disconnected a few wires and forgot to reconnect, as it were. So, yeah, there's a lot of the continuity that's very, very important in the story. So, yes, I do that because I'm shifting perspective all the time. I focus on the main characters, but I do like to shift. And that's just a type of storytelling. There are a lot of books that are written that way, and I like it that way. And I think for me, I'm comfortable with it because it falls out of the old reporting tradition where I interviewed so many people and got different perspectives on a certain issue. And I only took what I thought was necessary for the story. That's just basic reporting, to make sure you presented a fair story. So I think that practice and structure has stuck with me. I don't think I could write a first-person story. I think I probably would bore the reader, but some days I think about trying it. But, yeah, I do, as you say, John, I do have to go back and make sure that everything's connected. My wife is my number one editor. She's very good at spotting flaws in continuity. I have a few other people in my immediate circle before it goes through the editing process with the publisher. So we all do our best to make sure we catch everything.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Because besides the book, which is just out now, In Desperation, which is your third book now in your Jack Gannett series, and someone who's just realizing who you are, and they see all these books that are out, and so besides In Desperation, which they should go out and get and read because you've written them as standalones in the Jack Gannett, but they can go back and get the other ones, which one, if you're in an event like VoucherCon or Thriller Fest and people are coming up and they're like, oh, you wrote this book, and you're like, yeah, but you know what? Why don't you go back and, read In Desperation, but go back and read this one first, because this is probably one of the ones that is my most favorite that I think you'll get either the most enjoyment out or you understand who I am as a writer to be able to continue on with my books. Which one do you tell people to go get?
Oh, goodness. Well, I ask them first what they're looking for. Some don't mind starting with a standalone. And in that case, I recommend 6 Seconds. That's my big international global thriller standalone, which is doing quite well. Actually, it was number one on the Amazon UK free books. We've got a promotional deal going with Expedia there that's going to end in a few days. And, yeah, it was nice to be number one in any list around the world. And Tess Garrison, I think, asked me this afternoon. So that's okay. But for the standalone, that's a good book. I think it reaches everywhere, and I really think I hit the mark there. But nostalgically speaking, I would go back to Tom Reed in If Angels Fall. The book's still in print. It might be hard to get. You can order it online, and there's no
ebook. But they're available in ebook.
No, it's not yet. They didn't bring it out yet, and that's another issue with the older publisher, whether or not that will. Mm-hmm. My aim is to bring it out in an ebook, but it's only available as a paperback. But it can, eBay is still there. But anyway, it's that book that goes right back to the very first one I wrote. It was pre-internet, really, and set in San Francisco. I had a lot of help from the San Francisco homicide detail on that one. I'd been on assignment in San Francisco when it struck me to contact the guys later for a personal favor to be technical advisors on the book. Because it's a beautiful city, as you know, and I thought it was a great place to set something. So that one I think is great. And the one that followed it, Cold Fear, which is set in the Rockies in Montana, is also good. So I would name those two or three, actually, and 6 Seconds. I mean, all of them. Every author says read them all, but I know I've got 12 of them out there now, and I'm working on number 14, so it might not be possible to read them all immediately. But if you wanted to start following me, and most people do, they discover me, and they go right back chronologically, and they catch up to me. And it's nice to hear. They do have some trouble finding some of the ones that are not as widely available. The earlier books are not in e-versions, but we're working on that, John.
Well, yeah, and that's one thing that, you know, they definitely should be coming out is those, is the e-book formats with all those books, because there's no reason why they shouldn't. But I'll tell you, we got 60 seconds here. Rick Mofina, the book is In Desperation, rickmofina.com. Can you kind of tell everybody how can they get a little bit more in contact with you, give them your Facebook, you know, where you're going to be at coming up here in the next, what events you're going to be at?
Yeah, I'm going to be leaving for on the 15th, I believe. I'm going to St. Louis for BoucherCon. I hope you guys are going to be there.
We're not going to make it to BoucherCon in St. Louis this year, unfortunately. It's just not in the cars, unfortunately.
We'll miss you there. Well, I'm going to St. Louis for BoucherCon. I'm also nominated. The Panic Zone was nominated for a Seamus Award. So the award banquet's also in St. Louis around BoucherCon, so we'll be going to that banquet. And it was an honor and a thrill to have Jack Gannon 2 be nominated for a Seamus. What I'll be doing also is helping push dangerous women and desperate men online. For those who are interested in a quick online read, each story is available individually, and you can buy the collection online as well. And the information is all on my website, rickmofina.com. I'm on Facebook. There's the official website, Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter. And I got to take care after this of taking care of your friend request, John. I thought it clicked through, so my apologies there. I gave it a firm.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, I'll tell you, Rick, it's always a pleasure talking to you. I want to thank you so much. Like we said, the book is In Desperation. It is out now to be able to go and buy your website, rickmofina.com, that lists all of your books that people go back and listen and read. So, Rick, thanks so much for joining us today, and, you know, we will see you out on the trail sometime. We just don't know when.
Well, my thanks to you guys, and I appreciate deeply everything that you do. I mean, it's all one big community, and a high five to you guys. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and you enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you later, Rick.
Bye now.
All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, here we go. We have the rundown. StephenJames.net with his book, The Queen. You can go find out information, Facebook, Patrick Bauer series. Andrea Kramer, you can go to C-R-E-M-E-R, it's andreakramer.com or nightshadebook.com to find out more about her YA series. And we just had Rick Mofina on talking about In Desperation and his latest series. Well, we'll be back, I believe, next week. If we're not, got to look at the schedule. And check us out on Facebook, suspensemagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio to see the schedule and who's coming up. If you have any requests, send them to us, editor@suspensemagazine.com. Our September issue will be out shortly. We'll see you all later. Enjoy. Later.